On the Bechdel cast, the questions asked if movies have women in them. Are all their discussions just boyfriends and husbands, or do they have individualism? The patriarchy's effing vast. Start changing it with the Bechdel cast.
Hi, welcome to the Bechdel cast. My name's Jamie Loftus.
My name's Caitlin Durante.
And this is our podcast about the portrayal of women in film.
Oh.
You thought I was going to say movies. I said film today.
Wow. Yeah. Thank you. It is. You are right. We are the esteemed podcast that we are.
Do you know, a fun fact about us, we were not in the top 200 podcasts of the year.
Oh, bummer.
I know.
Well, tell your friends about us and get us into the top 200 people.
Jeez. Hate women.
It's true. And that's why we have to do this podcast. We base it loosely on the Bechdel test, or we use that as our jumping off point to initiate a bigger conversation about representation and portrayals of women in film.
We're now a film podcast. We're assholes now. Sorry.
We're pretentious as fuck.
Sorry.
And if you don't know what the Bechdel test is, it is a media test created by Alison Bechdel, and it requires that a film have two female identifying characters who are named. They must speak to each other, and their conversation cannot be about a man. And by our standards, it has to be at least a two-line exchange.
Oh, you think it'd be easy.
But it's not. But films actually are not
films
good.
Are bad. Which is why we do this podcast, because we hate movies. Mm-hmm. Really quick thing that will not pass the Bechdel test, but I feel compelled to tell you because I was so shocked. Also, I have a male dog now, which I know is upsetting, but I am training him to be, you know, an ally.
Oh, good. Okay.
He started humping my leg, and I was like, honey,
you did not consent.
I will consent. You may hump my leg. And then he continued. I'm like, he's learning.
Oh, good.
So I was walking my dog yesterday. Because I do that now. Mm-hmm. And I was catcalled from, wait for it, a Lime scooter. Someone passed me in a Lime scooter and was like, you're beautiful. I was like, oh my God. It was barely moving faster than I was. And he was just like, you're beautiful. And like passed me and my Doge. And it was unbelievable.
Okay, a couple questions.
Misogyny's alive and
well. One, if you are catcalled when you're with a dog, does that mean you're being dog called? Question number two, how many nipples does a cat call have?
Zero.
Oh, yeah.
Zero.
Well, I'm sorry that that happened to you.
I'm also sorry, but I almost wonder if it was history making. Mm-hmm. Was that the first time that someone had had the gall?
I feel
on their way back to presumably their grandma's house. So that's the update on me.
Yeah.
Dog, cat called on a Lime scooter. We're caught up.
Wow. Proud of you.
Thank you.
So the movie we're talking about today. The movie today is Fatal Attraction, and let's just get right into it. Let's introduce our guest.
Let's do it.
She is the author of Rage Becomes Her, The Power of Women's Anger, Soraya Shamali.
Thanks so much for having me today.
Thank you for being here.
Yeah, we're so psyched to talk about this very bizarre movie with you.
Yes. So what is your history, your relationship with this movie, Soraya?
Well, I really do associate this movie with like peak Susan Faludi backlash. Mm-hmm. That's my first association with it. I mean, I remember when it came out. I remember all the discussion around it. I remember variations on its themes over the years.
Yeah.
That's how I think of it.
Mm-hmm. When was the first time you saw it?
Oh, I saw it in the theaters when it came out.
Ooh, yeah. It seems like along with everyone else in the entire world at that time.
Uh-huh.
Well, you know, it was so notable. I mean, there were women gaining power, and that's always a frightening specter. And so these depictions tend to have a lot of resonance.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. We'll talk about it. But, Jamie, what is your history and relationship with the movie?
I have seen this movie a couple of times. I think I saw it for the first time in college as a part of probably the worst film class I ever took.
Uh-huh.
I think that the gender dynamics in this movie were completely not discussed in the class. It was just like, this is how you write amazing. A thriller. This is what a good thriller is. And yep. I remember it being the first time I was not the appropriate amount of horrified, I think, because I was just like 18 and didn't know anything about anything yet.
Sure.
But I've seen it a few times since. And with each passing viewing, there's like new stuff you see or have learned in the intermittent time where I'm just like, Jesus, it's just.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yikes.
Same. I saw it for the first time in college too. This was like when I was like, you know, a young film student hungry to consume all of the media that I could. And I knew about this movie. I already knew about the boiling bunny scene, so like that's mm-hmm. what I knew going into it. I saw it just that one time and then didn't revisit it until we were prepping for this episode. But yeah, it's a wild
this is one. What this is one of my mom's favorite movies.
Oh, Jill
is it really?
Yeah, she's I mean, and she it's weird because she was about my age when this movie came out. And she was like, oh, it's weird, but her opinions on it, she seems to both be aware of the issues, but still really loves the movie, where her whole thing was, she was like, well, yeah, Michael Douglas is so horrible. I'm not going to like fall for like him being the good guy, but I love the movie. And I love when Glenn Close yells. I was like, that's valid. Sure.
Wild. Okay, so should I do the recap?
Yeah.
Okay, so we meet Dan Gallagher, played by Michael Douglas. He yes, is
thick lawyer.
Thick lawyer living in New York City. Mm-hmm. He has a family, his wife Beth, and they have a young daughter, Ellen.
I love the daughter. She's so cute.
She's cute. And the baldest woman in charge.
She is. Yes, she's got a very short haircut.
Yeah. So he and his wife go to this work function, and that's where he meets Alex Forrest. That's Glenn Close's character.
Who, upon meeting her, seems very normal, little flirtatious.
Sure.
That's it.
And she was recently brought on to work as an associate editor at the publishing company that his law firm represents. I think I have all of that right. So Beth, Dan's wife, goes out of town for a few days.
His wife.
And Dan and Alex cross paths again because they're like working in the same vicinity and they're in a meeting together. And then it's raining. So they're like, oh, we can't be outside. Let's get a drink together.
Such a tenuous scene where they're like, it's wet. I'm like, you live here. Yeah.
He waits to open his umbrella until after he's already standing in the rain. I think this whole movie could have been avoided if he had just like been better at umbrellas.
Sucked it up. Yeah, yeah. There's God. It's like, it's raining. So I'm horny. Okay. End of first act.
Yeah. So they get a drink together, then things escalate from there. They wind up at one of their apartments. They frick.
We only say frick. Yeah.
They have sex, for those of you who don't know what fricking means.
They frick.
And then they spend a couple days together in, I wrote down coital bliss, and I regret writing that.
Caitlin.
But that is what I wrote, so I'm so sorry. I know. I forgot that we only say frick. Okay.
Oh, frick bliss.
Frick bliss. Coital fricking. at the end of these couple of days, he's like, look, I gotta go and we can't see each other again because I have his wife.
And, who is in the country trying to further domesticize him, the movie, whatever you believe, by trying to find a house for him to commute into the city and have a nicer, whatever,
right,
something about school
suburban,
districts and space,
right, yeah,
and grandparents.
This upsets Alex that she's told that he doesn't want to see her again. And she gets a little aggressive and she's yelling at him and she's kicking him. And then as he's about to leave, it's revealed that she has cut her wrists in a suicide attempt.
Yeah.
So he stays with her for a little longer and then she calms down and he's like, okay, everything's good here. See you never. Mm. And then Beth and Ellen come back home. And it seems like everything is back to normal. They're like considering buying this house.
They're freaking.
His daughter is doing magic tricks at him. But then Alex Forrest shows up at Dan's office and she apologizes and she's like, hey, I was going through a rough time. I was in a crisis. Why don't you go to the opera with me as a peace offering? But he declines. Doesn't think it's a good idea.
There's a whole overture of Madame Butterfly and how, which this becomes important with the ending the movie did not use.
Right.
Where the female protagonist kills herself at the end. But that we'll get into it.
Yeah. And it seems like Alex understands. He says, you know, that's not a good idea. I'm a married man. We shouldn't see each other again. And she's like, okay, cool. But then we cut to her at home and she's like crying. She's turning a lamp on and off over and over again. She's not doing
that
well.
That scene is insanely long.
Yeah, it
is. Sorry, that's just a thought. Loose thought.
And then she starts like calling his office and calling his home and... he does agree to meet up with her to be like, hey, stop bothering me. It's over. But then she's like, I love you. And also, I'm pregnant. Gregnant, sorry.
Gregnant, yes.
And she says she wants to keep the baby. So then she shows up at his apartment and is hanging out with his wife.
His wife.
Because she feigns an interest in buying the apartment that they are selling because they're moving into this new house. Mm-hmm. And she gets like he had unlisted his number. She gets his new number and she's like, hey, I'm going to have this baby. And Alex threatens to tell Beth. He's like, you know, if you're not a part of this, like, I'm going to tell you you're his wife. And then it seems like that might have worked. And then they move into their new house. He gets his daughter a pet rabbit. Mm-hmm. But then Alex pours acid, I think. Does something to his car.
I think it was acid.
Yeah, she pours acid on his car.
Classic.
And then she sends him an audio message on tape, which is basically a podcast. She's just like, hey, you suck. And I hate you. She uses some homophobic slurs here.
She does.
Dan goes to the police and he's like, hey, can something be done about this? But they are not helpful. Beth comes home. There's a pot boiling on the stove. She takes a lid off of it, and it is their daughter Ellen's bunny rabbit boiling on the stove. And she's like, what the hell? Dan is like, oops, gotta tell you something. I had an affair. She's pregnant. She's boiling our pets.
She's pregnant and crazy the implication. And... Dan's his wife is a very traditional his wife.
Yes.
And says, I'm mad.
But... I'm mad. Get out of here. But then in the next scene, they're together.
Temporary separation. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And Beth tells Alex that she will kill her if she comes near her family again. But then Alex kidnaps their daughter, Ellen.
Also, Arita believed that like the teachers at Ellen's school just had no idea what the mom looked like, because they're like, no, she got picked up already.
Right. I thought that we would maybe, when we saw Alex again, she would have had like maybe dyed her hair to like make her look like Beth, but that didn't happen. So yeah, they just like let any random woman pick up the children from this school.
I think she brings Ellen to what, like Coney Island or something?
Yeah, they ride a roller coaster. And Beth is driving around looking for Ellen and she gets into a car accident. But Alex drops off the little girl and returns her home safely. So now Dan goes after Alex. There's a big fight. He strangles her for a little bit. She tries to stab him. And then they calm down. He leaves. And then when Beth is taking a bath, probably like, I don't know, the next day or something like that, Alex shows up in the bathroom and she tries to kill Beth. Dan comes running in. Drowns her, we think, but then there's like one last jump scare. And then Beth shoots her. Sorry, it sounds like I'm crying, but I just am choking on something. So anyway.
Caitlin is just like, it's so sad.
I'm so sad that Glenn Close died.
So sad. I love Glenn Close. She's one of my favorite actresses. If you haven't seen Damages,
ooh,
you should see it.
Yeah. So anyway, so that's the story. Let's take a break for a second and then we'll come right back.
Where to begin?
Soraya, what are your kind of initial thoughts with this?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I think just around when that movie came out, I had just started working and there was just so much conversation about what it meant to have a working woman depicted as incapable of personal happiness, and indeed unhinged and defeated by a happy wife at home, right? Mm. Like that was the whole conversation, but it was just pretty stark. I mean, it was really remarkable to see the very successful trajectory of this movie that managed to make this sort of scumbag husband somehow seem sympathetic in light of the unhinged woman. It's also funny to me because I just also remember, that the crazier she got, the curlier her hair got.
That's what happens.
I remember thinking, thanks so much for that. Like just a bonus on top, right?
Demonizing curly haired people.
Yeah, well, you know, they got to be crazy, right. I think, right? And so, you know, I think it's a morality tale and it's a pretty blunt force instrument. It kind of takes a sledgehammer to the idea that here's a working woman who's very competent, who's, you know, has a sex life that's not related to reproduction. Indeed, hell, she kills small mammals. It doesn't really get more blunt than that, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
So yeah, I've always taken its success as kind of a symbolic step, like a clinging of the culture.
For sure. I feel like this is a movie where like a lot of men have seen and have used as an excuse to be like, yeah, women are crazy. Haven't you seen Fatal Attraction?
A story written and directed a man.
That's right. And it's like the My Crazy Ex-Girlfriend, the television show. There's this idea that crazy women stalk men and then maybe kill them. But they certainly set out to destroy their lives. And well, first of all, there are so many more women who are subjected to stalking. Thing one, right?
Right.
Mm-hmm. And thing two is it's very rarely the case that women actually have more economic power, more status, more credibility as leverage over a man that they choose to target for violence, you know?
Mm-hmm. Well, that was one of the main things that stuck out to me about this movie, where we've done so many movies on this podcast that feature the reverse stalking of a male character pursuing a female character. And it is very, very rarely, I don't think in any movie we've ever done anyways, that stalking tendencies are framed as scary or unhealthy when it's done.
Right.
From a man to a woman. Most of the movies that the stalking trope from a man towards a woman are rom-coms that are like classic.
Yeah, it's like kind of romantic. Funny, right? It's like, wow, look how much he loves
it's
her.
Persistence.
He's following her.
Exactly. Yeah.
And like, it's wearing her down until she's like, yep, we're in love.
And that's true love. Where have you, these.
Yeah, have you seen Unforgettable?
No.
No.
That just recently came out. I think who is in that? Unforgettable. It's a similar situation where there's actually a new wife and the ex-wife is Catherine Hegel, I believe. Mm-hmm. And she turns out to be really batshit crazy. And Rosario Dawson plays the new wife. I don't even know if it went to theaters. I saw it in an airplane, to be honest. But I did explicitly watch it because I was thinking of Fatal Attraction. I was like, okay, well, you know, this many years later, what does this look like?
Yeah.
And again, actually, there is this sort of cold professional woman in relief to the sort of softer, mellower literary arts magazine person. And one is crazy and one is not.
Yeah, there's, I mean, the Fatal Attraction model, I feel like has been recycled so many times. And like, based on the permutations of it I've seen, rarely strays from the format, no matter what year it's coming out in, where our producer Sophie was bringing up beforehand a movie I remember seeing in high school was Obsessed, which is basically Fatal Attraction, but Beyonce plays the good wife. And it's the same story, but like just a worse made movie. It's the same story.
Sure. And another movie that we've covered, Single White Female, which came out a few years after Fatal Attraction, but it's, you know, about this woman who targets another woman and basically, you know, copies her life and goes after her boyfriend and just like similar unhinged, scary, stalkerish behavior. And I don't know if filmmakers of this time were like, yeah, we gotta like push the bar and like, what if we saw a story about a woman stalker? And like, I don't know what they were thinking, but not to say that this...
I mean, there's a lot of that Madonna whore dichotomy, you know, the kind of good woman, bad woman, catfight, and women having to stay in their sphere, which is considered exhibiting power within the context of relationships to men. Right. You know, as I think really the more power women have in the culture institutionally, the more these narratives kept putting them back into these domestic arenas where they could duke it out.
It's interesting because I feel like this movie in particular is kind of firing on all cylinders in terms of putting women back in their place and making a female character who on paper seems to be pretty progressive and empowered and turning her into this monster, because there is a professional element to this where Glenn Close is very successful in her chosen field, and that is demonized against her. She's unmarried. That is demonized against her. And she's older, and that is held against her too, which I thought was especially strange in this movie, where I was just trying to catch up on the context of when this movie came out, and there was that Newsweek story that I've heard referenced before, but there was a story that came out in 86 that was like, women over 40 are more likely to get killed by terrorists than married.
I remember that.
Which is a soundbite I'd heard before, but I was like, oh, that was reported as news. Cool.
Right.
And so to see an older woman, and also women who have casual sex lives, like we're told to believe with the Glenn Close character, like even though it seems like she wants casual sex, every woman is actually like going for your seed, no matter what a like kind of a chump in Michael Douglas's case. It's like, nope, you can't be a woman over a certain age and not be like dying to reproduce with whoever.
Right. She says something like, I'm 36. This might be my last chance to have a baby.
Right.
And it just perpetuates this idea that, like, you know, women be baby crazy. Mm-hmm. Women be trying to trap a man with pregnancy. I forget which episode we talked about this on before, but there's like this male fear that like women are just like out to get pregnant by you so that she can trap you in her little talons and like keep you,
destroy your life. Right. So have you seen the Star is Born remake?
Oh, yes. Have we?
We certainly have.
We all saw it together in the theater.
So what kind of cracked me up about that, also having seen the first one, like, I don't know how old I was, like seven, but this one in particular struck me as quite a remarkable presaging of Me Too and everything that's come since, because in fact at the end all I kept thinking was, okay, so in order for a woman to self-actualize, to be professionally successful, a man literally has to die.
We did an episode about this movie, and we didn't put it in those words, but I mean, yeah.
But yeah, he had to, yeah, for her to have a fun show.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a British show called, I think, The Bodyguard. Have you seen this?
Mm-mm. No.
A bodyguard, he's in charge of guarding the British Prime Minister, who's a woman. Mm-hmm. And it also, I don't want to ruin it for you since you haven't seen it, but it has a very similar leitmotif, that there are women and that they have power and that the man is repeatedly constrained, punished, and destroyed by that fact.
Well, it seems like reparations. Don't these seem fair? There's a number of reasons why I would hope that this movie couldn't be made today in the same way, at least. Like, there's certainly plenty of masked misogyny in movies coming out now, but it's like, I feel like people at least have to take at least one or two precautions. But the way that we are conditioned by this movie to be like, oh no, the conflict is like woman versus woman, where the wife, you know, picks up on Alex, totally takes it at face value. Oh, well, my husband said she's nuts.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm just going to take that at face value, whatever that even means, and threaten to kill her on the phone.
Yes.
Which is and then the fact that Ann Archer's character kills Glenn Close at the end is very like, okay, so domesticity wins, and, you know, fidelity and standing by your man, regardless of what a chump loser he is, will always win the day.
Right.
And take down any woman in your path that will prevent you from that.
Mm-hmm.
Right. It's also, I think, a really good example of punching down, being allowed to punch down. Mm. In the book that I've written about anger, there's a lot about this idea that, you know, people who don't have power or status compared to other people can't express their anger at their oppressors or at the people exerting power over them. Mm-hmm. So the anger gets diverted. And so in day-to-day life, it means maybe somebody goes to work and they get really angry and frustrated, and then they go home and they yell at their children.
Yeah,
right?
Got it. Okay.
Or they get angry at someone in the line at the market or something. But I think it's a pretty good example over and over again when we see these stories where women's acceptable anger is aimed at other women, because there are times when we can be acceptably angry. We can be angry at other women, we can be angry at our mothers, and we can be angry at men with lower status, like men who are black or brown, right? Mm-hmm. But we can't be angry. The anger can't be aimed up, and it can't be aimed horizontally at men we consider our equals. And that's a test I use when I look at these movies that exhibit women's anger. I'm like, okay, well, how is the anger allowed to be used?
That's right. Fascinating.
Because Beth is angry much more so at Alex than she is at her husband. There's a brief outburst where she's like, get out of here. But then in the next scene, he's back at home. You know, they're like figuring this out together.
And the issue is that, like, Glenn Close was a temptress who, per, you know, Beth and Dan's version of the story, they're like, well, she tempted him to the point where he couldn't resist. And so she's
trying to...
Well,
he can't control himself.
Right.
Yeah.
And we just accept, like, well, men can't control themselves. So, sure, they should make more money than us. Yeah. Can we talk about the endings debacle with this movie? Hello, Anderson.
There's a dog. Yes.
Yeah, because the way the movie ends, Caitlin was re-watching the end of the movie when I came in today, and there's so much about it that is confusing, and it's because that wasn't supposed to be the actual ending the movie. So, and I remember reading about this a while ago, but like revisiting the journey of this movie ending the way it does, which is by Glenn Close, like, surprise, she isn't drowned and she gets killed by the wife. And so women shouldn't have jobs and they should marry guys named Dan.
Sure.
Great. But the way it was originally supposed to end, which is so well set up in the movie, like regardless of if you like the movie or not, the movie's supposed to end like Madame Butterfly, which they recap in full in the movie, which is that once the man leaves the woman, she kills herself in, you know, despair.
Right.
And that's how the movie ended, and that's filmed. It exists. You can,
she
I'm pretty sure, watch it.
She also basically frames him because she makes sure his fingerprints are on the knife that he picks up to almost... you know, or to whatever happens in that scene. So his fingerprints are on the knife, and then he gets arrested for her murder. That's how that was supposed to end. It didn't test well with audiences, so they rewrote it, they reshot it into the ending that we have now.
And something I thought was interesting was that, like, Michael Douglas was pro the ending that is in the movie. But the director, Adrian Lyne, or Lynn, which is it?
Not sure.
He directed a terrible version of Lolita. Anyways.
Oh, the one with Jeremy Irons?
The one with Jeremy Irons. Oh. It's
sick.
It is, I mean, it is a story not that shouldn't be filmed in the first place.
Correct.
But the way he does it is disgusting. But anyways, the director and Glenn Close were so resistant to change it, but they were studio notes into oblivion, and that's why we have the very confusing ending that exists now.
Right. Yeah, so like Alex shows up in the bathroom. She like got in undetected into their house, is in the bathroom with Beth, has a knife and makes stabbing motions at Beth, but somehow doesn't, like, she's striking her with the knife in her hand, but she doesn't get stabbed somehow. I guess she's punching her with the fist that she's holding the knife in, not clear. And then Dan has to come in and save her.
Yeah.
And then Beth ultimately shoots Alex to death. So it's like, right, the domestic figure triumphing over this woman that the movie has made you believe is evil.
Yeah.
And like, I have to admit, I was like falling for it even as I was watching it this time. Like whenever he's trying to kill her, I was like, yeah, she kidnapped a child. She like boiled a rabbit. Yeah, like she's a bad person. I want her to be defeated. But then I was like, wait a minute, this is the movie manipulating me into thinking this, and I shouldn't be feeling this way because the way the movie handles or doesn't handle like mental health and framing her as this unhinged woman without.
Yeah, I mean, this movie has no regard for a lot of things, mm-hmm. but like meant that the use of like the crazy woman trope is so, I mean, it's not just hack and tired, it's so oblivious to any mental health issue.
Right. In fact, according to the Amazon Prime trivia that mm-hmm. pops up when you're watching it there, boo to Amazon, but anyway, in a 2013 interview with CBS News, Glenn Close admitted that she would have rethought her portrayal of Alex Forrest because of her fear that the film's popularity may have been a contributing factor toward mental health stigma. Close said right. that I would have read the script totally differently. The astounding thing was that in my research for Fatal Attraction, I talked to two psychiatrists. Never did a mention of mental disorder come up. Never did the possibility of that come up. That, of course, would have been wow. the first thing I think of now. So she has, you know, in recent years, you know, what seems like expressing regrets on how this movie frames. So
Glenn,
good.
Glenn,
good for Glenn.
Glenn.
Because, right, the way, I mean, she attempts suicide and then she acts increasingly unstable and unhinged and violent and stalkerish. And
also, like, very clearly paints the suicide attempt as like, oh, it was strategic and she just wanted to reel you in and keep your attention. And,
yeah.
like, this is why someone would do that. And it, mm-hmm. yeah.
It's all... mishandled.
You know, I think it's interesting too that this movie came out maybe 6 or 7 years before Bill Clinton became president, mm-hmm. and was a real cultural moment, right? It was just huge. It was a global success. And then, you know, maybe, I don't know, not very long after that, you had Bill Clinton and Monica Lewinsky, and you had mm-hmm. issues with Hillary Clinton and, you know, whether she would stand by her man or not. And all of that feels like one long cultural nightmare moment, right?
Yes.
Like just the narrative of the film, the message it sent, the idea that somehow women are in control of men's sexuality and that they can be absolved of responsibility for the havoc they've wreaked. Mm-hmm. And that indeed Bill Clinton abusing the power that he abused in the White House, it can step back while the two women duke it out. Publicly, right?
Right.
And those feel very similar to me in terms of how the public deals with those issues or wants to deal with those issues or not.
Mm-hmm. I agree. I mean, just the concept of a homewrecker seems
right.
to be very prevalent in this and then the years that come after. The 80s, like movies, I struggle with a lot of movies from the 80s kind of for this reason, where there's misogyny in cinema in every year since film has existed.
Mm-hmm.
But like the 80s stands out to me particularly because there were so many things in the 70s that were positive and moving women in what would appear to be, you know, like more movies about women in the workplace. You've got Norma Rae. You've got like really cool, interesting movies like that. But then the 80s seems to kind of revel in setting it back mm-hmm. and being like, oh, wait, we accidentally made women too powerful. Now we've got to make them scary again and make a competent woman, you know, somehow nullify that.
Right. Yeah.
But, you know, I think it's interesting what we're seeing now, though, with witches, mm-hmm. because there's resurgence of witch narratives, right? Because we're talking about power and we're talking about anger. And the thing about witch narratives always is that they've always implied that there is crazy irrationality involved. And that the power women have is unnatural. It's never
yeah.
natural, right? It's extra natural. It's extraordinary. And it's not rational. The anger is never rational. The power is never rational. And that's the only thing that kind of really concerns me about all of these witchcraft narratives right now.
That's so interesting. Yeah, right. Because witchcraft narratives do tend to crop up in bulk.
Yes, they do.
For a while. And I was thinking, I mean, this is sort of off topic a little bit, why is both like witchcraft and like tarot and astrology seems to have come back in a major way in the past several years. And I think I sort of just was like, oh, well, this is probably like a societal response to dystopia, where everyone wants to believe in magic again, because we live in a very fashy world. But that makes a ton of sense of, you know, even though women are allowed to be powerful in these narratives, it is couched in like, but not every woman is like this. And like you have, and it can be dangerous.
Right.
And, yeah.
It's dangerous. And men are always at risk because the women have the power.
Yeah.
And it's not normal, right? That's the point about the women's power in witchcraft. It's not normal.
Right.
Yeah.
Wow. Thank you for making me think that. That's amazing.
We got to take a quick break, but we will be right back in a moment. Can we talk about the like pregnancy and abortion aspect of this, where she tells him that she is pregnant?
Gregnant.
He says that he will help her take care of it. Basically, he'll pay for the abortion. And she's like, no, I want to keep it. He says, well, don't I have any say in this? And part of me is like, her body, her choice. But she says she's going to have the baby, whether he wants to have anything to do with it or not. And we're like, okay. But then a moment later, she's like, well, I was hoping that you'd want to have something to do with it. And that's the whole like trapping him narrative of like, right. I'm keeping the baby so that hopefully you'll want to go out with
me. You'll have to be my boyfriend.
Right. And
no.
So, and then I guess he calls the doctor, her doctor, and the doctor confirms that she is pregnant. And I was like, wait, what about like doctor-patient confidentiality?
Yeah.
But then I looked up when HIPAA was I looked it up and HIPAA didn't go into effect until 96. So
Yeah. So you could just be some random guy and be like, hey.
Is this lady just pregnant?
Wow. Well, there you go.
Because this movie came out in, 87? Yeah.
Right. And now we live in a time where Amazon will tell you if you're pregnant before you know. So.
Right. Jeff Bezos knows about every drop of semen on the planet.
And then a little bit later, the Dan character says, like, look, whether or not you want to keep it, it's your choice. So I'm like, okay, pro-choice, Dan Gallagher, good for him.
Good for him.
But again, it does so much to reinforce this idea that so many men have, which is that, yep, women are crazy. You sleep with them and it's fun for a second, but then they're going to go ape shit on you and they're going to trap you and they're going to, you know, stalk you and this and this and that.
The thing that's most telling to me, and I guess why I brought up the two endings in the first place, is that, you know, at least two of them, and there is also, oh God, I can't remember what her name is. Let me pull it up. But the director, Glenn Close, and a producer named Sherry Lansing, who was like a very powerful producer this time, were all against changing the ending. But the audience response, and remember, this is like Reagan era, so scary, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
But like the audience response was so against it that they literally had no choice. The movie couldn't get released unless the far different ending that watching it now, you're like, wait, what is happening here?
Yeah.
Unless the thing that, you know, reinforced these very traditional oppressive values was included. And that was like the audience's decision.
Yeah.
And so it's like you can't even blame it on an executive, which is always fun to do.
Right. It was just the cultural landscape at the time.
Yeah.
And I think Sherry Lansing, I think one of her responses was, what do you mean it depicts professional women badly? I'm a professional woman.
Yes.
Which, of course, is irrelevant. Like, really. Has nothing to do with how the movie depicts this woman.
Yeah.
But that was her response in defense of producing the film, I think.
Right, which is like, I mean, that, I'm like, what do we make of that response? I mean, I don't know. Sometimes it's like when a woman's response to oppressing other women is like, but it's chill because like, women, right?
Well, I'm a woman, like, and no. I'm cool with it, so it's cool.
Like, no.
Right.
But
I also...
Interesting argument.
Just real quickly wanted to touch on, as per almost every movie in existence, this is an extremely white movie, but a few different times, a few of the white characters are, like, mocking specifically Japanese culture, because, like, at the very beginning, they're at this book event for this samurai self-help book, and... Dan and his friend are, like, making fun of the Japanese people there, and then they do it again later on when they're, like, having their, like, couples dinner together. They're, like, Reagan just, like, imitating them in a very offensive way. Yeah, it is not good in that regard.
Yeah, and also it's interesting because it is this very specific stereotype of a crazy angry woman that is tied to whiteness, to white women, right?
Yeah.
Like, we know the stereotypes for Black women. They're just born angry, right? Angry Black women is that stereotype.
Right.
And even little girls who are Black in school are tarred with that brush, right?
Sure.
And I think, too, we have, like, if you're Asian American or of Asian descent, you're sad, right? You have that whole trope. And if you're Hispanic, you're hot. But if you're white, you're crazy. Like, you know, you're literally insane. And I think that depiction is one that really sticks in people's heads. I mean, they refer still to Glenn Close's sort of mad expression and the boiling bunny. And I don't think you can separate it from her whiteness, you know?
And there's different, like, variations on that as like, you know, cinema has gone on, where I think that evolves into, like, the manic pixie dream girl trope that we see and things like that. But, yeah, it is real. It's like... upper class white woman equals crazy, I guess.
Well, I mean, and the, like, professional white woman is, like, it's like peak demonization here.
Right.
And there's so many variants of that theme in the 80s of, like, mean that trickles, like, even into now. But of, like, you know, a woman who is, wearing a any manner of shoulder pad is an evil person and is going to ruin your life.
Right.
Yeah. So, like, the demonization of women in the workplace, which, unfortunately, because the world, white women were sort of the first women welcomed into the higher echelons of the workplace. It's unfortunate. Mm-hmm.
Yes. Is there anything else that anyone wants to say about the film?
Well, I have a question for you.
Oh, please.
Do you think it would be any different if the original ending were run now, if this film were re-released?
Right.
As far as I can tell,
like,
the way the alternate ending was described to me, I don't like that ending any better, because I don't like this movie, I don't think. Like, I think it is an effective thriller. There are moments when I'm like, I'm scared. Ah. But, like, because of the way the movie handles and or mishandles so many things and perpetuates all these negative, you know, tropes and stereotypes about, you know, kind of specific types of women and stuff like that, and demonizes, you know, female sexuality. And because there's a moment where Alex says something like, I won't allow you to treat me like some slut you can bang a couple times and then throw in the garbage. So on one hand, like, her anger is, like, justified, because she's like, you know, you knew what you were doing and then you're going to dump me because you're going back to your wife and
but
all this stuff.
But the movie, like, equivocates, like, that rational statement with insanity.
Her being, exactly.
Right.
So it goes towards taking things in the right direction a couple times, but then immediately, like, backtracks on them. So to answer your question, I don't think it would have been that differently, because that ending is her committing suicide and then, like, framing him from beyond the grave.
Right.
And that's just as unhinged as everything else that happens.
Yeah, I agree. I don't think it's a better... I think, like, story-wise, it's an ending that makes more sense with the very, like, deeply troubled story that's been set up.
Right.
So strictly for story, it makes more sense. But I think that, like, especially where we already view her make a suicide attempt in front of him, that she follows through on it at the end. I don't know where that's, besides mirroring Madame Butterfly, I don't know what that does. I don't know. How do you feel about it, Soraya?
Well, the thing that occurred to me with the the ending that was eliminated actually was, it's funny to me that you said Glenn Close had commented on mental illness, because had she done that, I think you would have been more likely to leave with the feeling that she had a mental illness, because, you know, you don't get rebuffed and then try and kill yourself and then kill yourself. That's not the way that works. And so it actually would have veered away from the she's just a crazy woman narrative and the use of crazy in that very negative sense to, wow, you know, something's really wrong with this person. She needs help, which is a totally different thing. Nobody wanted to help Glenn Close, you know?
Right.
Yeah.
I guess that would end up eliciting a like sympathy. And
well, I mean, I don't necessarily think so, but I do think it was different, because you'd end up with a different feeling, right? Like it's just different than that hyper-violent catfighting that we got. But it's all within the parameters, as you say, of the fact that she's an unhinged woman, and that's what we're dealing with.
Yeah, I'm still trying to process the events of this movie after having rewatched it, and I can't do it.
It's weird.
Easily.
Yeah. It's. I mean, it's so ingrained into, like, people who haven't seen this movie are familiar with this, with the basics of what this movie did. And it's like, I've literally heard, you know, men cite this character as a reason to not trust a certain type of woman.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Right. That's true.
Glenn Close says, she said in 2008 that men still come up to her and say that her character scared the shit out of them, or that, like, her character saved their marriage, which, like,
oh my god,
I don't know.
Like,
I guess
we killed a lady and we have really been doing a lot better since.
Yeah, or that they were, like, inspired to either tell or not tell of their wives of their infidelity. I don't know. I can't even imagine what that would look like. But
just watch Damages, everyone.
Well, we're just about out of time, so let's discuss whether or not this movie passes the Bechdel test. Because it does a couple times.
So thinly.
Yes. But there is a moment between the daughter Ellen and her babysitter, who gets named as Christine, and it's played by Jane
Krakowski.
Yeah. They say, like, hey, Christine, hey, Ellen, how you doing? I'm good. Where's your mom? She's in the bathroom. Oh, I got you a present. Oh, I like it. Okay, let's go find
Great
mommy.
Great credit for Jane Krakowski. Her best role.
Yes. So that passes. It passes between Beth and Alex whenever Alex comes into their apartment, and they're talking about the apartment. They're talking about the cleaning lady. So, like, that's mostly happens, you know, you hear that dialogue kind of like happen off screen, but it's there. It passes. Yeah. And then there's the fun moment where Beth picks up the phone and she says, this is Beth Gallagher. If you ever come near my family again, I will kill you. You understand?
Yeah.
So, but Alex doesn't respond. So that does not pass.
Well, there you have it. It's a feminist text.
So let's rate it now on our nipple scale, 0 to 5 nipples based on its portrayal of women. It demonizes everything about an empowered woman, basically a woman who's in control of her sexuality, a career woman, you know, a woman who wants to have a baby. Like, just everything about it is, she's like, well, she's crazy and she's, you know, trying to trap him.
Yeah.
So I'm going to give it 0 nipples, I think.
I'm also going to give it 0 for all the reasons you described.
Me too.
Yeah.
Yeah. I can't stand Reagan era movies. just blanket statement. Anything that came out during his presidency, it tends to be regressive, capitalistic, and, like, just annoying to watch. I mean, I love that it makes me so angry. Just, I think that I just am on Team Glenn Close forever, but it makes me angry the way that Glenn Close, who was 40 when this movie came out, the way she was able to get a leading role was to play a character like this. Like, there were not that many options for women, you know, even over 35 playing leading roles at this time, because she was out of the ingenue zone. And so what she was relegated to were mother roles, or this new opportunity of being someone who's completely unhinged. And this was the way for her to get a leading role. You know, that's like, what kind of option is that?
Sure.
Zero yeah. nips.
So zero nipples across
That's
the board.
Right. Zero for me too.
Cool. All right. Well, Soraya, thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, my pleasure. That was really fun. I'm so sorry that I have to stop right now.
Oh, no, that's quite all right. Is there anything you would like to plug? Where can people follow you online?
Oh, so they can follow me on Twitter at @schemaly. Whenever I publish anything, I usually share it there or also in Facebook.
Great.
And also, I am the director of initiative at the Women's Media Center called the Speech Project, which focuses on women's civic and political participation.
Oh, very cool.
And so it's always easy to find me there, too.
Awesome. And read Soraya's book, Rage Becomes Her, The Power of Women's Anger. You can follow us, the Bechdelcast, at Bechdelcast on all of the platforms. You can go to our merch store at Bechdelcast.com or tpublic.com/TheBechdelcast. And we've got t-shirts, pillows, mugs, all phone cases, all of the goodies you could ever ask for. We've got cool designs like strong female protagonist, feminist icon, queer icon,
non-binary icon,
non-binary icon.
Baby Grinch with nipple tassels. Lot of wild stuff in the store.
Yeah, so get it now. And don't forget about our Patreon, aka Matreon. It is $5 a month, and you get 2 bonus episodes every single month.
I just felt it.
I guess we did talk about A Star Is Born in this episode.
We did. And tracks. I didn't even bring it up.
I know.
Soraya brought it up. So there. Yeah.
Well, everyone, thank you for listening.
Love ya.
Love ya, and we'll see you next time.
Bye.
Bye.